Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today. Hi listener, you are listening to episode 41 of the podcast. Adrian from Sofeast here, and I'm joined by our CEO Renaud, and we're discussing this new Cold War that's developing between China and the US. And I guess this kicked off with the trade war, which started happening maybe towards the end of the Obama presidency. And this has carried on, and we've seen Trump's tariffs, and we've seen a gradual worsening of the relationship between China and the USA, and of course other Western nations as well. So where does this leave manufacturing? What about you if you're actually manufacturing in China at the moment, and you're an American company, or you are from Europe perhaps? What's going to happen in the future? Are you going to be badly affected? What are we seeing now? Well, we're going to get into all of this in a little bit more of a political episode this time. So let's hear from Renaud. Hello, Renaud. How are you doing?
Hey, not bad. How are you?
Yeah, hanging in there. I noticed recently on LinkedIn, you posted out a Forbes article, which is entitled "Americans Fine with Paying More if Trading with Democracies, Not China." In the article, they polled a number of Americans, and they said that nearly 7 in 10 surveyed agreed with the statement, "Would you, as a consumer, be willing to pay up to 20% more for a good or service that you consume if that was to purchase it from another democracy instead of a cheaper alternative from a non-democracy, particularly if it has human rights problems?" So how realistic do you think that really is?
There is a big difference between what people say when asked a question and what people actually do, you know, in the supermarket or on Amazon. Well, first, the question itself says, you know, a non-democracy that has human right problems. I mean, that's like, whoa, that sounds horrible, right? Mm. So I'm going to have, you know, slave labor making my stuff, you know, and so on. I mean, this just sounds really bad. So the question is designed to prompt a higher than reality response first. Then let's say the question was, you know, framed in a better way. I mean, still 7 in 10 is high, you know.
Yeah.
Would they actually really pay something extra? All else being equal. Well, maybe a tiny bit extra, but, you know, not 2 or 3 times more, right? Not 20% more. Let's say you have, I don't know, you're going to buy an Android phone, and then you see all the specs, you know, are exactly the same. Maybe it's the same brand. Imagine, I don't know, Samsung, let's say, that made a phone in the USA, and then another phone with exactly the same specs in China, and you know there was a 15-20% price difference, but all the specs were the same. Would people actually pay more? I don't think so. I don't think so, especially as most of the components would come from China anyway. Mm. You know, it's just, okay, part of the manufacturing process is made in the USA versus China. You know, why is it worth much more, right? So I don't think so. And a lot of people commented on that. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussions about how much more it would cost. For electronics, it would be 2 or 3 times more, people say.
Yeah.
And it would still include a lot of components coming from China anyway. So in the end, you're still sort of giving them money. Mm. Some other people also, yeah, another person also said, hey, you know, it's a lot of products where you don't see where it's made. And like he was giving an example in France, you know, things like fruits and vegetables and things like that. You don't have to put a label on them to show where they come from, right? So people just don't know. And if people don't know, obviously, it's not going to help them make a choice, right? Now, if it's a phone, as I said, or a piece of furniture, or if you dig a little bit, usually you will know where it comes from, or a piece of clothing, or I mean, you just look at the care label, right? So I don't think a lot of people are really willing to pay more. Now, people who don't count when they spend, you know, yes, some of them will have a feel-good kind of feeling. Hey, yeah, okay, I paid something that was made here, not over there. You know, I don't even look at the price anyway. Yeah, it's two times more, I don't care. Some people are like that. That's true. However, they are not a majority of the people, and they don't even spend the majority of the money. So, well, all in all, this sort of militant consumerism is having an impact for, let's say, social compliance disasters. We've seen, you know, Nike was, you know, had a lot of issues with that, and some other brands, and even at some point Apple, because of some, you know, so-called waves of suicides at the Foxconn Shenzhen plant, which actually was very, very low in proportion. But anyway, yes. Journalists were happy to blow it out of proportion. And so when it comes to that, yeah, consumers, a certain number of consumers, especially for these kinds of, how to call that, aspirational brands, Nike, Apple, and others, consumers are not happy about that, and they turn away. That's true. So these brands have to make a lot of efforts and push their supply chains to pay more attention. Now, something, you know, very diffuse, like, you know, China, is not scaring people yet. Now, it's scaring the government when it comes to anything strategic or anything that, you know, like telecommunications, right? It's scared a number of governments, that's for sure. I would say it would scare car buyers. I don't think I would buy a car made in China, buy a Chinese brand. Now, made in China, of course, because there's a lot of JVs pretty well run with, you know, foreign companies, but I don't know if I would buy a Geely or a BYD car. So that's for sure. Now, in a lot of other categories, again, I mentioned garments, furniture, electronics, and, you know, home appliances and so forth. It's you know, it's sort of most of the products that you find in some stores anyway. There's nothing really wrong with them. They've earned the trust of consumers, you know, when it comes to safety and reliability, mostly. So just because it's not a democracy, well, you know, things would have to get much worse, I think, for militant consumers to really take a stand here.
I suppose we then start to question, is this sort of news, is this more of a political game playing that sort of feeds into the prevailing political will at the time? And of course, as we can see with the US and China, the US is definitely going through a sort of downward wave of sentiment towards China. And we've seen militant consumers, as you call them, they are actually having an effect on apparel, which you've pointed out. I mean, there's been quite big changes in how the apparel companies are operating and trying to market themselves these days. They've got to be very careful about, you know, recycling more and having less of an environmental impact. I think also cleaning products, things like this as well, personal care, all of these sort of things are undergoing quite a significant change due to people's will, the public's will to say, no, we want organic, we want something which is less harmful. So if they start to see more and more of this sort of news that, you know, China bad, human rights problems, China military bad, you know, and all of these sort of things start echoing and echoing, do you not see that that could really become a threat to made in China products?
It could, Yeah. So let me break it down into two things. You mentioned really two topics here that are interesting. The first one is, a lot of brands pay attention to their environmental impact and so on. Well, there's a lot of, you know, cheap grinning here. They're trying to say things that, you know, a fraction of their consumers like to hear. It doesn't really mean that they're doing, you know, a lot. It doesn't mean they're making a lot of efforts. You have the pioneers like Patagonia and others, and IKEA and some others that are really making efforts, that have been making efforts for a long time to really go to the heart of the problem, you know, really make a difference. And then you have all the others. Now, the worst is fast fashion, you know, the H&M and Forever 21 and all these guys. That's the worst, because number one, fast fashion, okay, so it's fast out of fashion also, and then people stop wearing it. Number two, a lot of pressure to produce very fast and not always in very good conditions. And, you know, when it's late, it's got to be sent by plane. I mean, fast fashion is the worst thing. I don't really like, you know, when it comes to environmental impact, it's one of the worst industries. So, sure. But still, you know, does it prevent people from going to H&M or Forever 21 or Zara? Well, Zara is a little bit special, but still, you know, I don't see many people going away from them because of that. So there's a lot of brands trying to do something to add one more, I don't know, marketing argument, if you want. Oh yeah, look, we do this, it's so nice. Yeah, great, but you know, it's only impacting 0.1% of, you know, all of your total impact on the environment. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous sometimes.
Yeah.
What they say. So I don't know if it's really down to you know, because 10 or 20 or 30% of their customers would go away, or if it's just, you know, yeah, let's try to build our brand, you know, as a nice, responsible brand. Let's try to put the idea in people's minds that we are sustainable, like it's safe to work with us, you know, to buy from us. I think that's mostly what's happening. We see it with a bunch of our clients. Oh yeah, we're developing this product, and you know, can you help us find some non-oil-based plastic for the enclosure or something like that? Whoa, you know, in the end, they always drop that idea once they see that it will actually have an impact on cost and, you know, make things a little bit harder and things like that. They're like, oh no, it's not worth it. They're basically looking for things that they can do without real impact on cost or delays or anything. And sometimes it's fine. I mean, if they say we want packaging with zero plastic, yeah, sure. I mean, depending on the product, it's not difficult, right? But again, if it were much more expensive, they would probably not do it. And they're basically looking for arguments, you know, for benefits for their marketing, because. And a lot of them are going to sell e-commerce. I mean, especially since the pandemic, it's kind of everybody's trying to do. Mm-hmm. And they think, hey, when someone Googles for whatever, yoga mat or whatever the product is on Amazon, I want to have something that sets me apart. And this is going to be the thing. And I don't know what it is, but I want the extra little edge that comes from being environmentally responsible or whatever, right? And they're looking for ideas. They don't even know what to do. They haven't studied the problem. They don't spend time studying the problem, but they come to us and say, yeah, you know, can you help us with this and with that? Maybe the packaging, maybe, you know, whatever is easier, you know, maybe this and this component, can we source them from like alternative sort of more eco-friendly sources and so on. And we're like, yeah, I mean, you know, you could do that or that, but, and they're like, yeah, it's, you know, it's not worth the effort. So there's a lot of that, and they're quite cynical about it. They don't really believe it. They just want to feed a story to consumers, and then they think that either they, you know, they can sell at the same price and make more sales, or maybe sell at a premium just because they're more green. It's just a little business tactic, right? There's nothing behind it, right? And there's a lot of that, but, and I agree with you, we see it a lot. But again, I don't think it's really driven by a lot of consumers really looking for something and pounding the brands for something more sustainable, you know? Unfortunately, we're not there. And so the second thing you mentioned is the sentiment toward China. Well, yeah, in the US, actually the Congress and the Senate were getting quite active against China before Trump arrived, and they would have implemented a lot of measures anyway, with or without Trump. So to a certain extent, it just followed a certain certain flow. It did not really create the new direction here.
Right.
He just went at it with his own methods, right? A lot of communication and a lot of symbols. And I'm not saying it's nothing, because his tariffs really hit a lot of companies. I'm not going to say it's nothing. but it did not really start with Trump. Now, Trump put it at the center of his, you know, his policies, and that has driven the anti-China sentiment, you know, further, probably than if someone else had been president. And so right now you have a clear majority of Americans who don't like, you know, when they hear China, they're like, you know, it's all negative to them.
Yeah.
And it's actually sort of the only thing that Democrats and Republicans kind of agree on. Yeah, let's go for China bashing, right? Just because, hey, we can be wrong here, right? Let's be tough, let's be idealistic, let's be whatever, and our voters will like it. You also have Australia. Australia has really taken a stand and is kind of paying the price for it. But they've really taken a stance. Now, in the UK, as you know, it's not that much better, actually, right?
Getting worse. Yeah, it's on the way down. The relationship between the UK and China, definitely.
Totally. And, well, there's a special case of a former colony. And yeah, a lot of stories around that, right?
So, yeah, that's not helping.
Yes. In continental Europe also, I mean, there's been a lot of stories, very negative, coming up. You know, it reminds me when I arrived in Hong Kong in, 2005, and not everybody, but a lot of people were like, China, you're going to China, be careful. Oh, you're going to Shenzhen. It's so dangerous, be careful, you know. And I was like, okay, yeah, you know, I go there like, you know, at least once a week, you know, to go see some suppliers and things like that. And it looks fine to me. Okay. But a lot of people were fed some stories every day. You have that in the news every single day on some news channels. You had some crazy stories about China, because, hey, there's over a billion people. Of course, you're going to find a crazy story if you look for it. And and then funny story is in 2008, actually, it really reversed with the Olympics. I don't know. Yes. There was a series of nice PR, I don't know, from China. They really did it the right way. And people in Hong Kong were kind of proud. Yeah, you know, yeah, like, we're proud of China. Yeah, that's great. I mean, this country is really on the rise. look at that, you know, number one. And then right after that, you had that scandal with the milk in you know, from Hubei, and you had several things, and then it kind of went down from there to probably an all-time high currently also. So, you know, it's been really bad PR. And it's been a lot of, I don't care what you think, series of actions. The leadership in Beijing has been, I'm sure has been following their interests, but they think probably much more about what their people in the country really think versus what people outside of their country think. And that really has an impact.
Yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for Beijing in general, though. And I mean, I'm not going to speak for all Western countries, but I'll speak for the UK. And, you know, as somebody who is friendly to China and has a lot of time for China, I try to look at things fairly. And, you know, if the British government says or does something, people here, perhaps they think, OK, yeah, that's good. We agree with that because we're British. But if the Chinese government does the same thing, people are like, oh, no, that's not okay. No, we don't trust China. This isn't good. And it's just looking at it from a Western viewpoint. And, you know, you've got to open up and respect the fact that, of course, China's going to look after Chinese interests and Chinese people. But that doesn't mean China's a wicked country that has, you know, sinister intentions all of the time.
Yeah, if you look at it from the European or American perspective of, you know, what a government should do and how it should act and everything, yes, certain things do look very bad. So I can understand, you know, why it really went down. And of course, with this very special virus that came out of we know what country, of course, things allegedly didn't get better. Yeah. Well, things didn't get better.
No.
And the way they, you know, they used their production of masks to help some of their allies, and you know how they cut off one, you know, their that island who they see as one of their provinces, you know, they cut them off of the WHO. They didn't want to share information about the vaccine with them and all kinds of things like that. You know, people see that and they're like, this is not proper, right? So plus what's happening in the west of China, there's a lot of things that people, like, you know, people are looking at, and journalists are really reporting on it, and there's some talks about regulations, and you know, there's a lot of talk about that. I mean, the journalists and the politicians really make sure that everybody is aware of it, right? And I just see things getting worse and worse. You know, I don't see things getting better in 2021 or 2022. I think the sentiment of Americans and Europeans toward China is going to be bad and getting worse.
Right, okay. And this leads me into this growing Cold War trend between the US and the West, perhaps, and China. And I guess when we look at a Cold War, we're looking at trends of decoupling, which we've discussed before, and also containment. And, you know, I was saying perhaps the last time a country or a region as the size of China was contained was probably in the 50s and 60s, which would of course have been the USSR by the US. So, you know, perhaps this media that we see, which is sort of anti-China, is kind of like a media containment, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, not just in the media. Look at what happened in Burma, in Myanmar recently, you know. So you have this government in place that the US and Europeans were kind of happy with, I mean, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, that government was put down by a group of, you know, generals, basically. And everybody knows that they are in very good terms with China. So you have this China versus USA sort of scenario here. And what does it remind you of? You know, I mean, Vietnam, Korea, you know. So basically, the US and the USSR did not go to war. However, there were a bunch of side conflicts around them where, you know, call them secondary conflicts, but it was basically all part of the same the same face-off, the same overall conflict, right? And it's, I'm just afraid of seeing that, you know, maybe in Burma, maybe soon, I don't know. I mean, there are countries heavily under Chinese influence. You know, Cambodia is full of China, full of Chinese. Yep. You know, to an extent, Vietnam is a very special case. Also, Thailand is kind of a special case. But still, there is definitely Chinese influence there. When you look at, India, that didn't go well. So there's very, very strong tension there. But there's a lot of influence over Pakistan.
Oh, lots. Yeah.
Because they're thinking, hey, this is our way to have like another port through the port there. There's a lot of direct influence over the direct neighbors, right? And I'm afraid of what's going to happen somewhere there. And I'm afraid of what might happen in the South China Sea, because that seems to be the hottest area, the one most prone to very serious conflicts. I mean,
China's increased its own naval power, which of course is you know, relevant to any kind of naval dispute. But on the other hand, you've got the US with enormous naval power, which is camped right next door to China. So is it wrong for China to do that? if you look at it through, and all of these Asian countries who are on good terms with China, and you know, you've got the Belt and Road Initiative as well, which is through Central Asia, going all the way through to Europe. All of this is definitely a manifestation of Chinese influence and Chinese power. Mm. But if you go back to the 20th century, you know, within even our lifetimes, this was exactly the same with the USA. Is it wrong that China is building up power and influence in the world just because, from a Western viewpoint, people say, oh, well, you know, it's not an English speaking country, or it's not a country with a Christian background. You know, we can't trust those guys, but it's OK when it's us. You know, I try to be really balanced about it, because I don't always look at something that China does and automatically think that it's, you know, sinister, which is definitely what the Western media tries to make out a lot of the time. And even this article that we initially discussed kind of feeds into that.
Yes. Now, these are good points. I mean, both of us have spent quite a bit of time in China, and we know how people there think, and it's very, 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 very different from Europeans or Americans. Even I have trouble sometimes, you know, thinking from the Chinese perspective. Sometimes I see some stuff, I'm like, oh, gee, what are they doing? And sometimes you try to take the long-term view and you say, they have these American military bases all around them, and they're sort of, you know, enclosed, and like this Korea and Japan closing this, and then to the north, it's too cold anyway, and then And then in the south, they have Taiwan, and they have, you know, all these other countries there. They want to cross the sea, like they want to breathe. They want to open all that up. I can understand the desire to do that. I can understand, like the, you know, why not us? Why are the Americans so powerful? We need to do something alternative. We need to have at least as much influence as them. I can understand that. You know, now the way they do it, and the open embrace of, you know, why give people the right to vote? Let's just be the best government we can. Yeah, of course. From a Chinese point of view, actually, it's not shocking. They always had a strong state. If you read the books from Francis Fukuyama, it makes it very clear. In China, you know, things like rule of law and, you know, forget about that. It's a very strong state. And then they also try to have a professional government. This has been more or less steady. In China, they try to have professional bureaucracy, right? And we see that very, very clearly these days with the CCP and all they're trying to do. They're trying to be professional. They're not trying to have, you know, a feudal society with, you know, the fathers, you know, passing the power to their sons and things like that. They're not into that. So they're kind of going back to their traditions, you know, of the what's been going on with their dynasties for a long time. So seen from that angle, you know, the way they're doing things is not that surprising. Now, the problem is, you know, if you really understand both sides, you're like, wow, these guys will never, 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 ever agree. They will never understand each other. Because let's say, for example, something very recent is the WHO so-called investigation into the origin of the virus. Well, okay. And then, of course, people say, well, yeah, but they were not given access to this. They were not given access to that. And then from the Chinese side, it's like, yeah, I mean, we don't know if we can trust you. We don't know how you're going to spin that. We don't know what, you know, if you have more facts, how people are going to interpret the facts in the West. Yeah, because absolutely. It's totally out of control. And because it is a fact that a lot of media are anti-China. So they will try to spin out any fact. So, but then at the same time, they're not transparent. So they, you know, they're feeding the narrative that these are just a bunch of liars. So you never get out of it, right?
No, you're right. You are right. So, I mean, that kind of covers the containment part of what I spoke about. I also mentioned decoupling. And I mean, we've spoken about decoupling in a manufacturing sense before, and that's very relevant, of course, to what we do. What, you know, a number of perhaps American customers of Sofist have been affected by. Now, when I interviewed Richard Barnett a couple of 3 weeks ago, he actually mentioned that although decoupling was kind of big news in the USA, in actual fact, they'd only seen a very small percentage of companies actually going through the process.
Remember, he is specialized in electronics. And yes. In electronics, there's been no decoupling. There's been some moving the final assembly, you know, just across the border on the other side, you know, in Vietnam, let's say, like Foxconn or Samsung. I mean, you look at their factories close to Hanoi, to just a few hours away from the border. So they're still close to their Chinese supply chain. And most of the value comes from the components, not from the final assembly. So that's one thing. And also in electronics, yeah, the second trend that's been happening is that some new products have been developed in Taiwan rather than in China, meaning that they have incorporated components that, you know, in good part come from local Taiwanese manufacturers rather than Chinese. And really in electronics, this has to be done at the stage of the new product development. You can't develop a product for manufacturing in China with a bunch of components from China and then say, okay, we're going to, you know, instead of sourcing these three critical, you know, the microcontroller, instead of buying it in China, we're going to buy it in Taiwan. No, sorry. You're basically redesigning your product. You're going to go through a lot of extra testing and extra validations and so on. It's going to be painful. So there has been some of that, but this has really been at the margin. It hasn't been a major movement, right? So that's in electronics. If we check, I don't know, if we talk about another industry, apparel, garment, where it's really easy to relocate. Whatever was chasing the cheapest needle has already gone out of China in very good part. So, you know, has China kept actually losing market share? You know, probably, but faster than it would have, you know, without the attempts at decoupling? I'm not sure. I haven't seen any clear statistics on that. What I see is that some countries like Vietnam obviously have gathered a lot of extra business, but very often the operations that they do are very, very low value added. It's just basic, simple final assembly. So in the end, you know, China is not really suffering from it. That's from my observations. Now, let's see, you know, I'm very, very open to seeing some data. Please, you know, if you come across something, send it to me. But it's not easy to really have a clear picture about that.
So for the time being, I mean, definitely politically, there's some sort of will to contain China, but in terms of tangible decoupling, perhaps this isn't something that's become such a big deal yet.
Right. Let's wait and see. There's, you know, success stories of companies that managed to relocate everything, you know, or move it completely out of Asia or maybe move some of it to Vietnam, some of it to Thailand and so on. But I don't know if these are, you know, 0.5% of the total volume versus, you know, 10, 20, 30%. And the situation is extremely different for small companies versus big companies. Big companies can relocate easier. If they decide to do so, they have the everything they need. They have the capability to relocate. Smaller companies really need to find the manufacturer that will make the final product just as they like. And that is much harder, especially when the product is actually not their product, but something that was developed by a Chinese factory and they just picked it in the showroom, right? So not easy.
No, I guess aside from apparel, really, for other product types, is very slim pickings if you look at other countries. I mean, I know Vietnam's had a lot of press in the last sort of couple of years, and foreign investment into Vietnam, by all accounts, has ballooned. But if you look at it in real terms, it's still a tiny, tiny percentage of what China's doing, I suppose.
Yes, it's, you know, I mean, think about it. It's just basically one province of China. Yeah. In terms of demography, and their level of automation is lower, so actually the productivity per head is probably lower. I mean, it's the value they add is not that high. That's what I would say.
Right. So I mean, maybe in 5 or 10 years, it will be possible to go to Vietnam and to find an entire supply chain there, I suppose, but at the moment, no.
Let's hope so. Yep. Let's hope so. Okay. Let's see.
Absolutely. Let's see. And let's hope everybody can just be friends as well.
Yes, that's another topic. Yes.
Right.
Let's hope.
That's right. Fingers crossed. Great. Thanks for catching up, Renaud, and to everybody listening.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Adrian. All right. Have a good one.
You too. Cheers.
Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.